Track 6.
Chantel turned and flew to Nicholas, taking his arm. Oh, Nicholas, that was unforgivable. I don't know what possessed me. Please don't go. And when he tried to disengage her hand, I beg you. For the first time ever, I beg you, Nicholas. Please don't go. He was still stiff with anger when he sank back on the sofa, and they were silent for nearly a minute while she regained her composure. This is all going so terribly badly. I didn't want this to happen. All right, let's get on to safer ground. Nicholas, she started, you and Daddy created Christy Marine. If anything, it was more yours than his. The great days were the last 10 years when you were chairman, all the tremendous achievements of those years. He made a gesture of denial and impatience, but she went on softly. Too much of your life is locked up with Christy Marine. You're still deeply involved, Nicholas. There are only two things that I'm involved with now, he told her harshly. Ocean Salvage and Nicholas Berg. We both know that's not true, she whispered. You are a special type of man. She sighed. It took me so long to recognize that. I thought all men were like you. I believed strength and nobility of mind were common goods on the market. She shrugged. Some people learn the hard way. And she smiled, but it was an uncertain, twisted little smile. He said nothing for a moment, thinking of all that was revealed by those words. Then he replied. If you believe that, then tell me what's worrying you. Nicholas, something is terribly wrong with Christy Marine. There's something happening there that I don't understand. Tell me. She turned her head away for a moment and then looked back at him. Her eyes seemed to change shape and color, growing darker and sadder. It's so difficult not to be disloyal, so difficult to find expression for vague doubts and fears. She stopped and bit her lower lip softly. Nicholas, I have transferred my shares in Christy Marine to Duncan as my nominee with voting rights. Nicholas felt the shock of it jump down his nerves and string them tight. He shifted restlessly on the sofa and stared at her, and she nodded. I know it was madness, the madness of those crazy days a year ago. I would have given him anything he asked for. He felt the premonition that she'd not yet told him all, and he waited while she rose and went to the window, looked out guiltily, and then turned back to him. May I get you a drink? He glanced at his Rolex. The sun is over the yardarm. What about Duncan? These days he's never home before 8 or 9. She went to the decanter on the silver tray and poured the whiskey with her back to him. Now her voice was so low that he barely caught the words. A year ago, I resigned as executrix of the trust. He did not answer. It was what he'd been waiting for. He had known there was something else. The trust that old Arthur Christie had set up was the backbone and sinews of Christie Marine. 1 million voting shares administered by 3 executors, a banker, a lawyer, and a member of the Christie family. Chantel turned and brought the drink to him. Did you hear what I said? She asked. And he nodded and sipped the drink before he asked, the other executors? Pickstone of Lloyds and Rollo still? She shook her head and again bit her lip. No, it's not Lloyds anymore. It's Cyril Forbes. Who's he? Nick demanded. He's the head of London and European. But that's Duncan's own bank, Nick protested. It's still a registered bank. And Rollo? Rollo had a heart attack 6 months ago. He resigned, and Duncan put in another younger man. You don't know him. My God. 3 men, and each of them is Duncan Alexander. He has a free hand with Christy Marine for over a year. Chantel, there's no check on him. I know, she whispered. It was a madness. I just can't explain it. It's the oldest madness in the world. Nick pitied her then. For the first time, he realized and accepted that she'd been under a compulsion, driven by forces over which she had no control, and he pitied her. I'm so afraid, Nicholas. I'm afraid to find out what I've done. Deep down, I know there is something terribly wrong, but I'm afraid of the truth. All right. Tell me everything else. There isn't anything else. If you lie to me, I cannot help you, he pointed out gently. I've tried to follow the new structuring of the company. It's also complicated, Nicholas. London and European is the new holding company, and... Her voice trailed off. It just goes round and round in circles, and I can't pry too deep or ask too many questions. Why not? He demanded. You don't know Duncan. I'm beginning to, he answered her grimly. But Chantel, you have every right to ask and get answers. Let me get you another drink. She jumped up lightly. I haven't finished this one. The ice has melted. I know you don't like that. She took the glass and emptied the diluted spirit, refilled it, and brought it back to him. All right, he said. What else? Suddenly she was weeping, smiling at him wistfully and weeping. There was no sobbing or sniffing. The tears merely welled up slowly as oil or blood from the huge dark eyes, broke from the thick arch lashes and rolled softly down her cheeks. Yet still she smiled. The madness is over, Nicholas. It didn't last very long, but it was a holocaust while it did. He comes home at 9 o'clock now, Nicholas said. Yes, he comes home at 9 o'clock. He took the linen handkerchief from his inner pocket and handed it to her. Thank you. She dabbed away the tears, still smiling softly. What must I do, Nicholas? Call in a team of auditors, he began. But she shook her head and cut him short. You don't know Duncan, she repeated. There's nothing he could do. He could do anything, she contradicted him. He's capable of anything. I'm afraid, Nicholas, terribly afraid, not only for myself, but for Peter also. Nicholas sat erect then. Peter, do you mean you're afraid of something physical? I don't know, Nicholas. I'm so confused and alone. You're the only person in the world I can trust. He could no longer remain seated. He stood up and began to pace about the room, frowning heavily, looking down at the glass in his hand and swirling the ice so that it tinkled softly. All right, he said at last. I'll do what I can. The first thing is to find out just how much substance there is to your fears. How will you do that? It's best you don't know yet. He drained his glass and she stood up, quick with alarm. You aren't going, are you? Now, there's nothing else to discuss now. I'll contact you when or if I learn anything. I'll see you down. In the hall, she dismissed the uniformed West Indian maid with a shake of her head and fetched Nicholas's top coat from the closet herself. Shall I send for a car? You'll not get a cab at 5 o'clock. I'll walk, he said. Nicholas, I can't tell you how grateful I am. I've forgotten how safe and secure it is to be with you. Now she was standing very close to him, her head lifted, and her lips were soft and glossy and ripe, her eyes still flooded and bright. He knew he should leave immediately. I know it's going to be all right now. She placed one of those dainty ivory hands on his lapel, adjusting it unnecessarily with that proprietary feminine gesture, and she moistened her lips. We're all fools, Nicholas, every one of us. We all complicate our lives when it's so easy to be happy. The trick is to recognize happiness when you stumble on it, I suppose. I'm sorry, Nicholas. That's the first time I've ever apologized to you. It's a day of many first times, isn't it? But I am truly sorry for everything I've ever done to hurt you. I wish with all my heart that it were possible to wipe it all out and begin again. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. With a major effort of will, he broke the spell and stepped back. In another moment, he would have stooped to those soft red lips. "I'll call you if I learn anything," he said, as he buttoned the top of his coat and opened the front door. Nicholas stepped out furiously, with the cold, striking colour in his cheeks. But her presence kept pace with him, and his blood raced not from physical exertion alone. He knew then, beyond all doubt, that he was not a man who could switch love on and off at will. "You old-fashioned thing." Samantha's words came back to him clearly. And she was right, of course. Hughes was cursed by a constancy of loyalty and emotion that restricted his freedom of action. He was breaking one of his own rules now. He was no longer moving ahead. He was circling back. He had loved Chantelle Christie to the limits of his soul, and had devoted almost half of his life to Christie Marine. He realized then that those things could never change, not for him, not for Nicholas Berg, prisoner of his own conscience. Suddenly he found himself opposite the Kensington Natural History Museum in the Cromwell Road, and swiftly he crossed to the main gates. But it was 5:45, and they were closed already. Samantha would not have been in the public rooms anyway, but in those labyrinthine vaults below the great stone building. In a few short days, she had made 6 cronies among the museum staff. He felt a stab of resentment, of jealousy, that she was with other human beings, reveling in their companionship, delighting in the pleasures of the mind, had probably forgotten he existed. Then, suddenly, the unfairness of it occurred to him, how his emotions of a minute previously had been stirring and boiling with the memories of another woman. Only then did he realize that it was possible to be in love with 2 different people, in 2 entirely different ways, at exactly the same time. Troubled, torn by conflicting loves, conflicting loyalties, he turned away from the barred iron gates of the museum. Nicholas's apartment was on the 5th floor of one of those renovated and redecorated buildings in Queen's Gate. It looked as though a party of gypsies were passing through. He had not hung the paintings, nor had he arranged his books on the shelves. The paintings were stacked against the wall in the hallway, and his books were pyramided at unlikely spots around the lounge floor. The carpet still rolled and pushed aside, 2 chairs facing the television set, and another 2 drawn up to the dining room table. It was an eating and sleeping place, sustaining the bare minima of existence. In 2 years, he had probably slept here on 60 nights, few of them consecutive. It was impersonal. It contained no memories, no warmth. He poured a whiskey and carried it through into the bedroom, slipping the knot of his tie and shrugging out of his jacket. Here it was different, for evidence of Samantha's presence was everywhere. Though she had remade the bed that morning before leaving, still she had left a pair of shoes abandoned at the foot of it, a booby trap to break the ankles of the unwary. Her simple jewellery was strewn on the bedside table, together with a book, Noel Mostert's Supership, opened face down and in dire danger of a broken spine. The cupboard door was open, and his suits had been bunched up in one corner to give hanging space to her slacks and dresses. 2 very erotic and transparent pairs of panties hung over the bath to dry. Her talcum powder still dusted the tiled floor, and her special fragrance pervaded the entire apartment. He missed her with a physical ache in the chest, so that when the front door banged, and she arrived like a high wind shouting for him, "Nicholas, it's me," as though it could possibly have been anyone else. Her hair tangled and wild with the wind and high colour under the golden tan of her cheeks. He almost ran to her and seized her with a suppressed violence. "Wow," she whispered huskily. "Who is a hungry baby then?" And they tumbled onto the bed, clinging to each other with a need that was almost desperation. Afterwards, they did not turn the lights on in a room that had gone dark, except for the dim light of the street lamps, filtered by the curtains and reflected off the ceiling. "What was all that about?" she asked, then snuggled against his chest. "Not that I'm complaining, mind you. I've had a hell of a day. I needed you badly." "You saw Duncan Alexander?" "I saw Duncan." "Did you settle?" "No. There was never really any chance." "I'm hungry," she said. "Your loving always makes me hungry." So he put on his pants and went down to the Italian restaurant at the corner for pizzas. They ate them in bed with a white Chianti from whiskey tumblers. And when she was finished, she sighed and said, "Nicholas, I have to go home." "You can't go," he protested instantly. "I have work to do also." But he felt a physical nausea, the thought of losing her. "But you can't go before the hearing." "Why not?" "It would be the worst possible luck. You are my fortune." "A sort of good luck charm?" She pulled a face. "Is that all I'm good for?" "You're good for many things. May I demonstrate one of them?" "Oh, yes, please." An hour later, Nick went for more pizzas. "You have to stay until the 27th, he said, with his mouth full. "Darling Nicholas, I just don't know. You can ring them. Tell them your aunt died, that you're getting married." "Even if I were getting married, it wouldn't lessen the importance of my work. I think you know that is something I will never give up." "Yes, I do know, but it's only a couple of days more." "All right. I'll call Tom Parker tomorrow." Then she grinned at him. "Don't look like that. I'll be just across the Atlantic. We'll be virtually next-door neighbors." "Call him now. It's lunchtime in Florida." She spoke for 20 minutes, wheedling and charming, while the blood-curdling transatlantic rumblings on the receiver slowly muted to reluctant and resigned mutterings. "You're going to get me into trouble one of these days, Nicholas Berg," she told him primly as she hung up. "Now, there is a happy thought," Nick agreed, and she hit him with her pillow. The telephone rang at 9:02 the next morning. They were in the bath together, and Nicholas swore and went through naked and steaming and dripping suds. "Mr. Berg?" James Teacher's voice was sharp and businesslike. "You were right. Christy Marine, petition for postponement of hearing late yesterday afternoon." "How long?" Nicholas snapped. 90 days. "The bastard," grunted Nick. "What grounds?" "They want time to prepare their submission." "Block them," Nick instructed. "I have a meeting with the secretary at 11. I'm going to ask for an immediate preliminary hearing to set down and confirm the return date." "Get him before the arbitrators," said Nick. "We'll get him." Samantha welcomed him back to the tub by drawing her knees up under her chin. Her hair was piled on top of her head, but damp wisps hung down her neck and onto her cheeks. She looked pink and dewy as a little girl. "Careful where you put your toes, sir," she cautioned him, and he felt the tension along his nerves easing. She had that effect on him. "I'll buy you lunch at Laissez if you can tear yourself away from your microscope and fishy-smelling specimens for an hour or two."
"Les Ambassadeurs, I've heard about it.
For lunch there, I'd walk across London on freshly amputated stumps. That won't be necessary, but you'll have to charm a tribe of wild desert sheiks. I understand they are very sympathetic towards blondes. Are you going to sell me into a harem? Sounds fun. I've always fancied myself in baggy, transparent bloomers. You. I'm not selling. Icebergs I am. I'll pick you up at the front gates of the museum at 1 o'clock sharp. She went with laughter and a great clatter and banging of doors, and Nicholas settled at the telephone. I'd like to speak to Sir Richard personally. It's Nicholas Berg. Sir Richard was at Lloyd's, an old and good friend. Then he called and spoke to Charles Gras. There were no new delays or threats to Sea Witch's completion date. I'm sorry for any trouble you had with Alexander. Ça ne fait rien, Nicholas. Good luck at the hearing. I'll be watching the Lloyd's list. Nicholas felt a sense of relief. Charles Gras had risked his career to show him Golden Dawn. It could have been serious. Then Nick spoke for nearly half an hour to Bernard Wackie of Bark Wackie in Bermuda. Warlock had reported on the telex 2 hours previously. She was making good passage with her oil rig tow. Would drop off at Bravo 2 on schedule and pick up her next tow as soon as she'd anchored. David Allen is a good youngster, Bernard told Nick. But have you got Le Voisin for Sea Witch? Jules is playing the prima donna. He's not said yes yet, but he'll come. You'll have a good team then. What's the latest date for Sea Witch? End March. The sooner the better. I've got contracts to keep both tugs running hard until the iceberg project matures. I'm having lunch with the sheikhs today. I know, there's a lot of interest. I've got a good feeling. There's something big brewing, but they're a cagey bunch. The inscrutable smile on the face of the Sphinx. When do we see you? I'll come across just as soon as I've got Duncan Alexander into the arbitration court. End of the month, hopefully. We've got a lot to talk about, Nicholas. Nick hesitated for the time it took to smoke the first cheroot of the day before he called Monte Carlo. For the call would cost him at least $50,000, probably closer to $75,000. The best is always the cheapest, he reminded himself. Picked up the receiver and spoke to a secretary in Monte Carlo, giving his name. While he waited for the connection, he thought how his life was complicating itself once more. Very soon, Bark Wackie would not be enough. There would have to be a London branch of Ocean Salvage, offices, secretaries, files, accounts, and then a New York branch, a branch in Saudi, the whole cycle again. He thought suddenly of Samantha, uncluttered and simple happiness, life without its wearisome trappings. Then the connection was made, and he heard the thin, high, almost feminine voice. Mr. Berg, Claude Lazarus. No other greeting, no expressions of pleasure at the renewal of contact. Nick imagined him sitting at his desk in the suite high above the harbour, like a human fetus, preserved in spirits, bottled on the museum shelf. The huge, bald, domed head, the soft, putty-coloured, rudimentary features, the nose hardly large enough to support the thick spectacles, the eyes distorted and startled by the lenses, changing shape like those of a fish in an aquarium as the light moved. The body underdeveloped, as that of a fetus, narrow shoulders seemingly tapering away to the bowed question mark of a body. Mr. Lazarus, are you in a position to undertake an in-depth study for me? It was the euphemism for financial and industrial espionage. Claude Lazarus's work was not limited by frontiers or continents. It spanned the globe with delicately probing tentacles. Of course, he piped softly. I want the financial structuring, the lines of control and management, the names of the nominees and their principals, the location and interrelationship of all the elements of the Christie Marine Group and London European Insurance and Banking Company Group, with particular reference to any changes of structure during the previous 14 months. Do you have that? This is being recorded, Mr. Berg. Of course. Further, I want the country of registration, the insurers and underwriters of all bottoms traceable to their holdings. Please continue. I want an accurate estimate of the reserves of London and European insurance in relation to their potential liability. Continue. I am particularly interested in the vessel Golden Dawn, presently building the yards of Construction Navale Atlantique at Saint-Nazaire. I want to know if she's been chartered or has contracted with any oil company for carriage of crude, and if so, on what routes and at what rates. Yes? Lazarus squeaked softly. Time is of the essence, and as always, so is discretion. You need not have mentioned that, Mr. Berg. My contact, when you're ready to pass information, is Bark Wacky in Bermuda. I will keep you informed of progress. Thank you, Mr. Lazarus. Good day, Mr. Berg. It was refreshing not to have to pretend to be the bosom comrade of somebody who supplied essentials, but nonetheless revolted him. Nick thought, and comforting to know, he had the best man in the world for the job. He looked at his watch. It was lunchtime, and he felt the quick lift of spirits at the thought of being with Samantha. Lime Street is a narrow alleyway with tall buildings down each side of it, which opens off Leadenhall Street. A few yards from the junction, on the left-hand side as you leave the Street of Shipping, is the covered entrance to Lloyd's of London. Nicholas stepped out of James Teacher's Bentley and took Samantha on his arm. He paused a moment with a feeling of certain reverence. As a seaman, the history of this remarkable institution touched him intimately. Not that the building itself was particularly old or venerable. Nothing now remained of the original coffee house, except some of the traditions. The caller, who intoned the broker's names like the offertory in the temple of some exotic religion. The stalls, in which the underwriters conducted their business, and the name and uniform of the institution's servants. The waiters, with brass buttons and red collar tabs. Rather, it was the tradition of concern that was enshrined here, the concern for ships and for all men who went down to the sea in those ships and did their business in great waters. Perhaps later, Nicholas would find time to take Samantha through the Nelson Rooms and show her the displays of memorabilia associated with the greatest of Britain's sailors, the plate and letters and awards. Certainly, he would have her as lunch guest in the big dining room, at the table set aside specifically for visiting sea captains. But now there were more important considerations to demand all his attention. He'd come to hear the verdict given on his future. Within a few hours, he would know just how high and how fast the wave of his fortune had carried him. "Come," he said to Samantha, and led her up the short flight of steps into the lobby, where there was a waiter alerted to receive them. "We will be using the committee room today, sir." The earlier submissions by both parties had been heard in one of the smaller offices. Heading off the high gallery above the vast floor of the exchange, with its rows of underwriter stalls. However, due to the extraordinary nature of this action, the Committee of Lloyd's had made a unique decision: to have their arbitrators give their findings and make their award in surroundings more in keeping with the importance of the occasion. They rode up in silence, all of them too tense to make the effort of small talk, and the waiter led them down the wide corridor, past the chairman's suite of offices, and through the double doors into the grandeur of the room designed by Adams for Bowood House, the country home of the Marquess of Lansdowne. It had been taken to pieces panel by panel, floor, ceiling, fireplace and plaster mouldings, transported to London and re-erected in its entirety with such care and attention that when Lord Lansdowne inspected it, he found that the floorboards squeaked in exactly the same places as they had before. At the long table, under the massive glittering pyramids of the three chandeliers, the two arbitrators were already seated. Both of them were master mariners, selected for their deep knowledge and experience of the sea, and their faces were toughened and leathery from the effects of sea and salt water. They talked quietly together, without acknowledging in any way the rows of quietly attentive faces in the rows of chairs facing them, until the minute hand of the antique clock on the Adams fireplace touched its zenith. Then the president of the court looked across at the waiter, who obediently closed the double doors and stood to attention before them. This arbitration court has been set up under the Committee of Lloyds and empowered to receive evidence in the matter between Christie Marine Steamship Company Limited and the Ocean Salvage and Towage Company Limited. This court finds common ground in the following areas. Firstly, a contract of salvage under Lloyd's open form, no cure, no pay, for the recovery of the passenger liner Golden Adventurer, a ship of 22,000 tons gross burden and registered at Southampton, exists between the parties. And secondly, that the master of the Golden Adventurer, while steaming on a southwesterly heading during the night of December the 16th at or near 72 degrees 16 south and 32 degrees 12 west. The president let no dramatics intrude on his assembly of the facts. He recounted it all in the driest possible terms, succeeding in making Golden Adventurer's plight and the desperate endeavours of her rescuers sound boring. Indeed, his colleague seemed to descend into a condition of coma at the telling of it. His eyes slowly closed, and his head sagged gently sideways, his lips vibrating slightly at each breath, a volume not quite sufficient to make it a snore. It took nearly an hour, with the occasional consultation of the ship's logbooks and a loose volume of handwritten and typed notes, before the president was satisfied that he'd recounted all the facts. And now he rocked back in his chair and hooked his thumbs into his waistcoat. His expression became decisive, and while he surveyed the crowded room, his colleague stirred, opened his eyes, took out a white linen handkerchief, and blew two sharp blasts, one for each nostril, like the herald angel sounding the crack of doom. There was a stir of reawakened interest. They all recognized the moment of decision. And for the first time, Duncan Alexander and Nicholas Berg looked directly at each other over the heads of the lawyers and company men. Neither of them changed expression, no smile nor scowl, but something implacable and clearly understood passed between them. They did not unlock their gaze until the president began to speak again. Taking into consideration the foregoing, this court is of the firm opinion that a fair and good salvage of the vessel was effected by the salvors, and that therefore they are entitled to salvage awards commensurate with the services rendered to the owners and the underwriters. Nicholas felt Samantha's fingers groping for his. He took her hand, and it was slim and cold and dry. He interlocked their fingers and laid their hands upon his upper thigh. This court, in arriving at the value of the salvor's services, has taken into consideration, firstly, the situation and conditions existing on the site of operations. We have heard evidence that much of the work was carried out in extreme weather conditions, temperatures of 30 degrees below freezing, wind forces exceeding 12 of the Beaufort scale, and extreme icing. We've also considered that the vessel Golden Adventurer was no longer under command, that she had been abandoned by her passengers, her crew, and her master. She was aground on a remote and hostile coast. We have further noted that the salvors undertook a voyage of many thousands of miles without any guarantee of recompense, but merely in order to be in a position to offer assistance should that have become necessary. Nicholas glanced across the aisle at Duncan Alexander. He sat at ease, as though he were in his box at Ascot. His suit was of somber gunmetal grey, but on him it seemed flamboyant, and the Zingari tie as rakish as any of Cardin's fantasies. Duncan turned the fine leonine head and looked directly at Nicholas again. This time, Nicholas saw the deep, angry glow in his eye, as when a vagrant breeze fans the coals of an open fire. Then Duncan turned his face back towards the president, and he balanced his thrusting square chin on the clenched, carefully manicured fingers of his right fist. Furthermore, we have taken into consideration the transportation of the survivors from the site of the striking to the nearest port of succor, Cape Town, in the Republic of South Africa. The president was summing up strongly in favor of ocean salvage. It was a dangerous sign. So often a judge about to deliver an unfavorable decision prefaced it by building a strong case for the loser and then tearing it down again. Nicholas steeled himself. Anything below $3 million would not be sufficient to keep ocean salvage alive. That was the barest minimum he needed to keep Warlock afloat and to put Sea Witch on the water for the first time. He felt the spasms of his stomach muscles as he contemplated his commitments. Even with $3 million, he would be at the mercy of the sheikhs, unable to maneuver, a slave to any conditions they wished to set. He would not be off his knees again. Nicholas squeezed Samantha's hand for luck, and she pressed her shoulder against him. $4 million would give him a fighting chance, a slim margin of choice, but he would still be fighting hard, pressed on all sides. Yet he would have settled for $4 million if Duncan Alexander had made the offer. Perhaps Duncan had been wise after all. Perhaps he might yet see Nicholas broken at a single stroke. Three. Nicholas held the figure in his head. Let it be three. At least, let it be three. This court has considered the written reports of the Globe Engineering Company, the contractors charged with the repairing and refurbishing of Golden Adventurer, together with those of two independent marine engineering experts, commissioned separately by the owners and the salvors to report on the condition of the vessel. We've also had the benefit of a survey carried out by a senior inspector of Lloyd's of London. From all of this, it seems apparent that the vessel sustained remarkably light damage. There was no loss of equipment, the salvors recovering even the main anchors and chains. Strange how that impressed a salvage court. We took her off, anchors and all, Nick thought with a stir of pride. Prompt anti-corrosion precautions by the salvors resulted in minimal damage to the main engines and ancillary equipment. It went on and on. Why cannot he come to it now? I cannot wait much longer, Nicholas thought. This court has heard expert opinion and readily accepts that the residual value of the Golden Adventurer's hull, as delivered to the contractors in Cape Town, can be fairly set at $26 million, or £15,300,000. And in consideration of the foregoing, we are further of the firm opinion that the salvors are entitled to an award of 20% of the residual hull value. For long, cold seconds, Nicholas doubted his hearing. Then he felt the flush of exultation burning on his cheeks. In addition, it was necessary to compute the value of the passage provided to the survivors of the vessel. It was $6 million. He was clear and running free as a wild albatross sweeping across the oceans on wide pinions. Nicholas turned his head and looked at Duncan Alexander, and he smiled. He never felt so strong and vital and alive in his life before. He felt like a giant, immortal, and at his side was the vibrant young body pressing to him, endowing him with eternal youth. Across the aisle, Duncan Alexander tossed his head, a gesture of dismissal, and turned to speak briefly with his counsel, who sat beside him. He did not look at Nicholas, however, and there was a waxen cast to his skin, as though it had a fine sheen of perspiration laid upon it, and the blood had been drained away beneath the tan. Anyway, another few days and you'd probably have started to find me a boring dolly bird, or one of us would have had a heart attack. Samantha smiled at him, a pathetic, lopsided little grin, nothing like her usual brilliant, golden, flashing smile. I like to quit while I'm still ahead. They sat close on the couch in the Pan Am Clipper Lounge at Heathrow. Nicholas was shocked by the extent of his own desolation. It felt as though he were about to be deprived of the vital forces of life itself. He felt the youth and strength draining away as he looked at her and knew that in a few minutes she would be gone. "Samantha," he said, "stay here with me." "Nicholas," she whispered huskily, "I have to go, my darling. It's not for very long, but I have to go." "Why?" he demanded. "Because it's my life. Make me your life." She touched his cheek as she countered his offer. "I have a better idea. Give up Warlock and Sea Witch, forget your iceberg, and come with me." "You know, I can't do that." "No," she agreed. "You could not, and I would not want you to. But Nicholas, my love, no more can I give up my life." "All right, then. Marry me," he said. "Why, Nicholas?" "So I don't lose my lucky charm. So that you damn well have to do what I tell you." And she laughed delightedly and snuggled against his chest. "It doesn't work like that anymore, my fine Victorian gentleman. There's only one good reason for marrying Nicholas, and that's to have babies. Do you want to give me a baby?" "What a splendid idea. So that I can warm the bottles and wash the nappies while you go off to the ends of the oceans, and we'll have lunch together once a month." She shook her head. "We might have a baby together one day, but not now. There's still so much to do. There's still too much life to live." "Damn it." He shook his head. "I don't like to let you run around loose. Next thing, you'll take off with some 25-year-old oaf, bulging with muscles and..." "You have given me a taste for vintage wine." She laughed in denial. "Come as soon as you can, Nicholas. As soon as you have done your work here, come to Florida, and I'll show you my life." The hostess crossed the lounge towards them, a pretty smiling girl in the neat blue Pan Am uniform. "Dr. Silver, they're calling flight 432 now." They stood and looked at each other, awkward as strangers. "Come soon," she said, and then stood on tiptoe and placed her arms around his shoulders. "Come as soon as you can." Nicholas had protested vigorously as soon as James Teacher advanced the proposition. "I don't want to speak to him, Mr. Teacher. The only thing I want from Duncan Alexander is his check for $6 million, preferably guaranteed by a reputable bank, and I want it before the 10th of next month." The lawyer had wheedled and jollied Nicholas along. "Think of the pleasure of watching his face. Indulge yourself, Mr. Berg. Gloat on him a little." I will obtain no pleasure by watching his face. Offhand, I can think of a thousand other faces I'd rather watch. But in the end, Nicholas had agreed, stipulating only that this time the meeting should be at the place of Nicholas's choice, an unsubtle reminder of whose hand now held the whip. James Teacher's rooms were one of those picturesque stone buildings in the Inns of Court, covered with ivy, surrounded by small velvety lawns, bisected with paved walkways that connected the numerous blocks, the entire complex reeking with history and tradition and totally devoid of modern comforts. Its austerity was calculated to instill confidence in the clients. Teachers' rooms were on the third floor. There was no elevator, and the stairs were narrow, steep, and dangerous. Duncan Alexander arrived slightly out of breath and flushed under his tan. Teacher's clerk surveyed him discouragingly from his cupel. "Mr. Who?" he asked, cupping his hand to one ear. The clerk was a man of as old, grey, and picturesque as the building. He even affected a black alpaca suit, shiny and greenish with age, together with a butterfly collar and a black string tie like that last worn by Neville Chamberlain as he promised peace in our time. "Mr. Who?" And Duncan Alexander flushed deeper. He was not accustomed to having to repeat his name. "Do you have an appointment, Mr. Arbuthnot?" the clerk inquired frostily, and laboriously consulted his diary before at last waving Duncan Alexander through into the Spartan waiting room. Nicholas kept him there exactly 8 minutes, twice as long as he himself had waited in the boardroom of Christie Marine. And he stood by the small electric fire in the fireplace, not answering Duncan's brilliant smile as he entered. James Teacher sat at his desk under the windows, out of the direct line of confrontation, like the umpire at Wimbledon, and Duncan Alexander barely glanced at him. "Congratulations, Nicholas." Duncan shook that magnificent head, and the smile faded to a rueful grin. "You turned up one for the books, you truly did." "Thank you, Duncan. However, I must warn you that today I have an impossible schedule to meet. I can give you only 10 minutes. Nicholas glanced at his watch. "Fortunately, I can imagine only one thing that you and I have to discuss. The 10th of next month, either a transfer to the Bermuda account of Ocean Salvage or a guaranteed draft by registered airmail to Back Wacky." Duncan held up his hand in mock protest. "Come now, Nicholas. The salvage money will be there on the due date set by the court." "That's fine," Nicholas told him, still smiling. "I have no taste for another brawl in the debtor's court." "I wanted to remind you of something that old Arthur Christie once said." "Ah, of course. Our mutual father-in-law," Nicholas said softly, and Duncan pretended not to hear. Instead, he went on, unruffled. "He said that, with Berg and Alexander, I have put together one of the finest teams in the world of shipping." The old man was getting senile towards the end. Nicholas had still not smiled. "He was right, of course. We just never got into step. My God, Nicholas, can you imagine if we had been working together instead of against each other? You, the best salt and steel man in the business, and I'm touched, Duncan, deeply touched by this new and gratifying esteem in which I find myself held." "You rub my nose in it, Nicholas, just as you said you would. And I'm the kind of man who learns by his mistakes. Turning disaster to triumph is a trick of mine." "Play your trick now," Nicholas invited. "Let's see you turn $6 million into a flock of butterflies." $6 million in Ocean Salvage would buy you back into Christie Marine. We'd be on equal terms. The surprise did not show on Nicholas's face. Not a flicker of an eyelid, not even a tightening of the lips, but his mind raced to get ahead of the man. Together, we would be unstoppable. We would build Christie Marine into a giant that controlled the oceans. We'd diversify out into ocean oil exploration, chemical containers. The man had immense presence and charm. He was almost, but not quite, irresistible. His enthusiasm brimming and overflowing, his fire flaring and spreading to light the dingy room. And Nicholas studied him carefully, learning more about him every second. Good God, Nicholas, you're the type of man who can conceive of a venture like the Golden Dawn or salvage a giant liner in a sub-zero gale. And I'm the man who can put together $1 billion on a wink and a whistle. Nothing could stand before us. There'd be no frontiers we could not cross. He paused now and returned Nicholas's scrutiny as boldly, studying the effect of his words. Nicholas lit the cheroot he was holding, but his eyes watched shrewdly through the fine blue veil of smoke. I understand what you're thinking, Duncan went on, his voice dropping confidentially. I know that you're stretched out. I know you need those 6 big M's to keep ocean salvage floating. Christie Marine will guarantee ocean salvage outstandings. That's a minor detail. The important thing is us together, like old Arthur Christie saw it, Berg and Alexander. Nicholas took the cheroot from his mouth and inspected the tip briefly before he looked back at him. Tell me, Duncan, he asked mildly, is this great sharing you envisage? Do we put our women into the kitty also? Duncan's mouth tightened, and the flesh wrinkled at the corners of his eyes. Nicholas, he began. But Nicholas silenced him with a gesture. You said that I need that 6 million badly, and you're right. I need 3 million of it for ocean salvage, and the other 3 to stop you running that monster you've built. Even if I don't get it, I will still use it to stop you. I'll slap a garnishy order on you by 9:10 in the morning of the 11th. I told you I would fight you and Golden Dawn. The warning still stands. You're being petty, Duncan said. I never expected to see you join the lunatic fringe. There are many things you don't know about me, Duncan. But by God, you're going to learn the hard way. Chantel had chosen San Lorenzo in Beecham Place when Nicholas had refused to go again to Eaton Square. He'd learned it was dangerous to be alone with her, but San Lorenzo was also a bad choice of meeting ground. It carried too many memories from the golden days. It had been a family ritual, Sunday lunch whenever they were in town. Chantel, Peter and Nicholas laughing together at the corner table. Mara had given them the corner table again. "Will you have the ossobuco?" Chantel asked, peeping at him over the top of her menu. Nicholas always had the ossobuco, and Peter always had the lasagne. It was part of the ritual. "I'm going to have a sole." Nicholas turned to the waiter, who was hovering solicitously. "And we'll drink the house white." Always the wine had been a Sancerre. Nicholas was deliberately downgrading the occasion by ordering the carafe. "It's good." Chantel sipped it and then set the glass aside. "I spoke to Peter last night. He's in the San with flu, but he'll be up today and he sent you his love." "Thank you." He spoke stiffly, stilted by the curious glances from some of the other tables where they'd been recognized. The scandal would fly around London like the plague. "I want to take Peter to Bermuda with me for part of the Easter holidays," Nicholas told her. "I shall miss him. He's such a delight." Nicholas waited for the main course to be served before he asked bluntly, "What do you want me to speak about?" Chantelle leaned towards him, and her perfume was light and subtle and evocative. "Did you find out anything, Nicholas?" "No," he thought to himself. "That's not what she wants." It was the passion in her blood, the love of secrecy, the intrigue. There was something else here. "I have learned nothing," he said. "If I had, I would have called you." His eyes bored into hers, green and hard and searching. "That is not what you wanted," he told her flatly. She smiled and dropped her eyes from his. "No," she admitted, "it wasn't." She had surprising breasts. They seemed small, but really they were too big for her dainty body. It was only their perfect proportions and the springy elasticity of the creamy flesh that created the illusion. She wore a flimsy silk blouse with a low, lacy front, which exposed the deep cleft between them. Nicholas knew them so well, and he found himself staring at them now. She looked up suddenly and caught his eyes, and the huge eyes slanted with a sly, heart-stopping sexuality. Her lips pouted softly, and she moistened them with the tip of her tongue. Nick felt himself sway in his seat. It was a telltale mannerism of hers. That set of lips and movement of tongue were the heralds of her arousal, and instantly he felt the response in his own body, too powerful to deny, although he tried desperately. "What was it?" He did not hear the husk in his voice, but she did, and recognized it as readily as he had the flicker of her tongue. She reached across the table and took his wrist, and she felt the leap of his pulse under her fingers. "Duncan wants you to come back into Christie Marine," she said. "And so do I." "Duncan sent you to me?" And when she nodded, he asked, "Why does he want me back? God knows what pains the two of you took to get rid of me." And he gently pulled his wrist from her fingers and dropped both hands into his lap. "I don't know why Duncan wants it. He says that he needs your expertise." She shrugged, and her breast moved under the silk. He felt the tense ache in his groin. It confused his thinking. "It isn't the true reason, I'm sure of that. But he wants you." "Did he ask you to tell me that?" "Of course not." She fiddled with the stem of her glass. Her fingers were long and perfectly tapered, the painted nails set upon them with the brilliance of butterflies' wings. "It was to come from me alone." "Why do you think he wants me?" "There are two possibilities that I can imagine." She surprised him sometimes with her almost masculine appraisal. That was what made her lapse so amazing. As he listened to her now, Nicholas wondered again how she would ever have let control of Christie Marine pass to Duncan Alexander. Then he remembered what a wild and passionate creature she could be. "The first possibility is that Christie Marine owes you $6 million, and he's thought up some scheme to avoid having to pay you out." "Yes," Nicholas nodded. "And the other possibility?" "There are strange and exciting rumors in the city about you and Ocean Salvage. They say that you're on the brink of something big, something in Saudi Arabia. Perhaps Duncan wants a share of that." Nicholas blinked. The iceberg project was something between the sheikhs and himself. Then he remembered that others knew. Bernard Wacky in Bermuda, Samantha Silver, James Teacher. There had been a leak somewhere then. "And you? What are your reasons?" "I have two reasons, Nicholas," she answered. "I want control back from Duncan. I want the voting rights in my shares, and I want my rightful place on the trust. I didn't know what I was doing. It was madness when I made Duncan my nominee. I want it back now, and I want you to get it for me." Nicholas smiled, a bitter, wintry smile. "You're hiring yourself a gunman," just the way they do in the Western serials. Duncan and I alone in the deserted street, spurs clinking. The smile turned to a chuckle, but he was thinking hard, watching her. Was she lying? It was almost impossible to tell. She was so mysterious and unfathomable. Then he saw tears well in the depths of those huge eyes, and he stopped laughing. Were the tears genuine, or all part of the intrigue? You said you had two reasons. And now his voice was gentler. She did not answer immediately, but he could see her agitation, the rapid rise and fall of those lovely breasts under the silk. Then she caught her breath with a little hiss of decision, and she spoke so softly that he barely caught the words. I want you back. That's the other reason, Nicholas. And he stared at her while she went on. It was all part of the madness. I didn't realize what I was doing, but the madness is over now. Sweet, merciful God, you'll never know how much I've missed you. You'll never know how I've suffered. She stopped and fluttered one small hand. I'll make it up to you, Nicholas. I swear it to you. But Peter and I need you. We both need you desperately. He could not answer for a moment. She had taken him by surprise, and he felt his whole life shaken again, and the separate parts of it tumbled like dice from the cup of chance. There's no road back, Chantel. We can only go forward. I always get what I want, Nicholas. You know that, she warned him. Not this time, Chantel. He shook his head, but he knew her words would wear away at him. Duncan Alexander slumped on the luxurious calf-hide seat of the Rolls, and he spoke into the telephone extension that connected him directly with his office in Leadenhall Street. Were you able to reach Kurt Streicher? He asked. I'm sorry, Mr. Alexander. His office was unable to contact him. He's in Africa on a hunting safari. They don't know when to expect him back in Geneva. Thank you, Myrtle. Duncan's smile was completely lacking in humor. Streicher was suddenly one of the world's most industrious sportsmen. Last week he'd been skiing and was out of contact. This week he was in Africa, slaughtering elephant. Perhaps next week he'll be chasing polar bears in the Arctic. And by then, it would be too late, of course. Streicher was not alone. Since the salvage award on Golden Adventurer, so many of his financial contacts had become elusive. Veritable will-o'-the-wisps, skipping ahead of him with their checkbooks firmly buttoned up into their pockets. I shall not be back at the office again today, he told his secretary. Please have my pending tray sent round to Eaton Square. I'll work on it tonight, and do you think you could get in an hour earlier tomorrow morning? Of course, Mr. Alexander. He replaced the handset and glanced out of the window. The Rolls was passing Regent's Park, heading in the direction of St. John's Wood. Three times in the last 6 months he had taken this route, and suddenly Duncan felt that hot, scalding lump deep under his ribs. He straightened up in his seat, but the pain persisted, and he sighed and opened the rosewood liquor cabinet, spilled a spoonful of the powder into a glass, and topped it with soda water. He considered the turbid draught with distaste, then drank it at a gulp. It left an aftertaste of peppermint on his tongue, but the relief was almost immediate. He felt the acid burn subside, and he belched softly. He did not need a doctor to tell him it was a duodenal ulcer, and probably a whole bunch of them. Or was that the correct collective noun, a tribe of ulcers, a convocation? He smiled again, and carefully combed his brazen waves of hair, watching himself in the mirror. The strain did not show on his face, he was sure of that. The facade was intact, devoid of cracks. He'd always had the strength, the courage to ride with his decisions. This had been a hard ride, however, the hardest in his life. He closed his eyes briefly and saw golden dawn standing on her ways, like a mountain. The vision gave him strength. He felt it rising deep within him, welling up to fill his soul. They thought of him only as a money man, a paper man. There was no salt in his blood, nor steel in his guts. That's what they said of him in the city. When he'd ousted Berg from Christie Marine, they'd shied off, watching him shrewdly, standing aside and waiting for him to show his guts, forcing him to live upon the fat of Christie Marine, devouring himself like a camel in the desert, running him thin. The bastards, he thought. But it was without rancor. They'd done merely what he would have done. They had played by the hard rules which Duncan knew and respected. And by those same rules, once he'd shown his guts to be of steel, they would ply him with largesse. This was the testing time. It was so close now, 2 months still to live through. Yet those 60 days seemed as daunting as the hard year through which he'd lived already. The stranding of Golden Adventurer had been a disaster. Her hull value had formed part of the collateral on which he'd borrowed. The cash she generated with her luxury cruises was budgeted carefully to carry him through the dangerous times before Golden Dawn was launched. Now, all that had altered drastically. The flow of cash had been switched off, and he had to find 6 million in real hard money, and find it before the 10th of the month. Today was the 6th, and time was running through his fingers like quicksilver. If only he'd been able to stall Berg. He felt a corrosive welling up of hatred again. If only he'd been able to stall him. The bogus offer of partnership might have held him just long enough, but Berg had brushed it aside contemptuously. Duncan had been forced to scurry about in undignified haste, trying to pull together the money. Kurt Streicher was not the only one suddenly unavailable. It was strange how they could smell it on a man. He had the same gift of detecting vulnerability or weakness in others, so he understood how it worked. It was almost as though the silver blotches showed on his hands and face, and he walked the city pavements chanting the old leper's cry, "Unclean, beware, unclean." With so much at stake, it was a piddling amount. 6 million for 2 months. The insignificance of it was an insult, and he felt the tension in his belly muscles again and the rising hot acid sting of his digestive juices. He forced himself to relax, glancing again from the window to find that the Rolls was turning into the cul-de-sac of yellow-faced brick apartments piled upon each other like hen coops, angular and unimaginatively lower middle class. He squared his shoulders and watched himself in the mirror, practicing the smile. It was only 6 million. And for only 2 months, he reminded himself, as the Rolls slid to a halt before one of the anonymous buildings. Duncan nodded to his chauffeur as he held the door open and handed Duncan the pigskin briefcase. Thank you, Edward. I should not be very long. Duncan took the case, and he crossed the pavement with the long, confident stride of an athlete, his shoulders thrown back, wearing his top coat like an opera cloak, the sleeves empty and the tails swirling about his legs. And even in the grey overcast of a March afternoon, his head shone like a beacon fire. The man who opened the door to him seemed only half Duncan's height, despite the tall black Homburg hat that he wore squarely over his ears. "Mr. Alexander, shalom, shalom." His beard was so dense and bushy black that it covered the starched white collar and white tie, regulation dress of the strict Hasidic Jew. "Even though you come to me last, You still bring honor on my house. And his eyes twinkled, a mischievous sparkling black under thick brows. That is because you have a heart of stone and blood like iced water, said Duncan. And the man laughed delightedly, as though being paid the highest compliment. Come, he said, taking Duncan's arm. Come in. Let us drink a little tea together, and let us talk. He led Duncan down the narrow corridor, and halfway they collided with two boys wearing yarmulke on their curly heads, coming at top speed in the opposite direction. The ruffians, cried the man, stooping to embrace them briefly, and then send them on their way with a fond slap on their backsides. Still beaming and shaking the ringlets that dangled out from under the black Homburg, he ushered Duncan into a small, crowded bedroom that had been converted to an office. A tall, old-fashioned, pigeonholed desk filled one wall, and against the other stood an overstuffed horsehair sofa on which were piled ledgers and box files. The man swept the books aside, making room for Duncan. Be seated, he ordered, and stood aside while a jolly little woman his size brought in the tea tray. I saw the award court's arbitration on Golden Adventurer in Lloyd's List, the Jew said when they were alone. Nicholas Berg is an amazing man, a hard act to follow. I think that is the expression. He pondered, watching the sudden bloom of anger on Duncan's cheeks and the murderous expression in the pale eyes. Duncan controlled his anger with an effort, but each time that somebody spoke that way of Nicholas Berg, he found it more difficult. There was always the comparison, the snide remarks, and Duncan wanted to stand up and leave this cluttered little room and the veiled taunts, but he knew he could not afford to. Nor could he speak, yet, for his anger was very close to the surface. They sat in silence for what seemed a long time. How much? The man broke the silence at last, and Duncan could not bring himself to name the figure, for it was too closely related to the subject that had just infuriated him. It's not a large amount, and for a short period, 60 days only. How much? 6 million, Duncan said. Dollars. 6 million is not an impossibly large amount of money when you have it, but it is a great fortune when you do not. The man tugged at the thick black bush of his beard. And 60 days can be an eternity. I have a charter for Golden Dawn, Duncan said softly. A 10-year charter. He slipped the 9-carat gold catches on the slim, finely grained pigskin briefcase and brought out a batch of Xeroxed sheets. As you see, it's signed by both parties already. 10 years? Asked the man, watching the papers in Duncan's hand. 10 years? At 10 cents 100 ton-miles, and a guaranteed minimal annual of 75,000 miles. The hand on the man's thick black beard stilled. Golden Dawn has a burden of 1 million tons. That will gross a minimum of $75 million a year. With an effort, he managed to disguise his awe, and the hand resumed its gentle tugging at the beard. Who is the charterer? The thick eyebrows formed two thick black question marks. Orient Amex, said Duncan, and handed him the Xerox papers. The El Barras field. The man's eyebrows stayed up as he read swiftly. You are a brave man, Mr. Alexander, but I never once doubted that. He read on in silence for another minute, shaking his head slowly so that the ringlets danced on his cheeks. The El Barras field. He folded the papers and looked up at Duncan. I think Christy Marine may have found a worthy successor to Nicholas Burke. Perhaps the shoes are even a little small. Maybe they will begin to pinch your toes soon, Mr. Alexander. He squirmed down in his chair, thinking furiously, and Duncan watched him, hiding his trepidation behind a remotely amused half-smile. What about the environmentalists, Mr. Alexander? The new American administration, this man Carter, is very conscious of environmental dangers. The lunatic fringe, said Duncan. There's too much invested already. Orient Amex have nearly $1 billion in the new cadmium cracking plants at Galveston, and three of the other oil giants are in it. Let them fuss. We'll still carry in the new cad-rich crudes. Duncan spoke with the force of complete conviction. There's too much at stake. The potential profits are too large, and the opposition is too weak. The whole world is sick of the doom merchants, the woolly-headed sentimentalists. He dismissed them with a short, abrupt gesture. Man has already adjusted to a little oil on the beaches, a little smoke in the air, a few less fish in the sea or birds in the sky, and he'll go on adjusting. The man nodded, listening avidly. Yes, he nodded. You are a brave man. The world needs men like you. The important thing is a cadmium catalyst cracking system, which breaks down the high carbon atoms of crude and gives back a 90% yield in low carbon instead of 40%, what we hope for now. 90% yield, double profits, double efficiency, and double danger. The man smiled behind his beard. There is danger in taking a bath. You might slip and crack your skull, and we haven't invested $1 million in bathing. Cadmium, in concentrations of 100 parts to the million, is more poisonous than cyanide or arsenic. The cad-rich crudes of the El Barris field are concentrated 2,000 parts to the million. That's what makes them so valuable. Duncan nodded. To enrich crude artificially with cadmium would make the whole cracking process hopelessly uneconomic. We've turned what appeared to be a hopelessly contaminated oil field into one of the most brilliant advances in oil refining. I hope you've not underestimated the resistance to the transportation of... Duncan cut him short. There will be no publicity. The loading and unloading of the crude will be conducted with the utmost discretion, and the world will not know the difference. Just another ultra-tanker moving across the oceans with nothing to suggest that she is carrying cad-rich. But just suppose the news did leak. Duncan shrugged. The world is conditioned to accept anything, from DDT to Concord. Nobody really cares anymore. Come hell and high water, we'll carry the El Barris oil. Nobody is strong enough to stop us. Duncan gathered his papers and went on softly. I need $6 million for 60 days, and I need it by noon tomorrow. You are a brave man, the man repeated softly. But you are finally stretched out. Already my brothers and I have made a considerable investment in your courage. To be blunt, Mr. Alexander, Christy Marine has exhausted its collateral. Even Golden Dawn is pawned down to her last rivet, and the charter for Orient Amex does not change that. Duncan took another sheaf of papers, bound in a brown folder, and the man lifted an eyebrow in question. My personal assets, Duncan explained, and the man skimmed swiftly through the typed lists. Paper values, Mr. Alexander. Actual values are 50% of those you list, and that is not $6 million of collateral. He handed the folder back to Duncan. They will do for a start, but we'll need more than that. What more is there? Share options, stock options in Christy Marine. If we are to share risk, then we must have a share of the winnings. Do you want my soul also? Duncan demanded harshly, and the man laughed. We'll take a slice of that as well, he agreed amiably. It was 2 hours later that Duncan sank wearily into the leather work of the rolls. The muscles in his thighs trembled as though he had run a long way, and there was a nerve in the corner of his eye that jumped as though a cricket was trapped beneath the skin. He had made the gamble. Everything. Christy Marine, his personal fortune, his very soul. It was all at risk now. Eaton Square, sir? The chauffeur asked. No, Duncan told him. He knew what he needed now to smooth away the grinding, destroying tension that racked his body. But he needed it quickly, without fuss, and like the peppermint-tasting powder, like a medicine. The Senator Club in Frith Street, he told the chauffeur. Duncan lay face down on the massage table in the small green-curtained cubicle. He was naked, except for the towel, and his body was smooth and lean. The girl worked up his spine with strong, skilled fingers, finding the little knots of tension in the sleek muscle and unravelling them. "Do you want the soft massage, sir?" she asked. "Yes," he said, and rolled onto his back. She lifted away the towel from around his waist. She was a pretty blonde girl in a short green tunic with the golden laurel leaf club insignia on the pocket, and her manner was brisk and businesslike. "Do you want any extras, sir?" Her tone was neutral, and she began to unbutton the green tunic automatically. No, Duncan said. No extras. And closed his eyes, surrendering himself completely to the touch of her expert fingers. He thought of Chantel, feeling the sneaking guilt of the moment. But it was so seldom these days that he had the energy for her smouldering, demanding Persian passions. He did not have the strength for her. He was drained and weary, and all he wanted was the release, swift and simple. In 2 months' time, it would be different. He would have the strength and energy to pick the world up in his bare hands and shake it like a toy. His mind was separated from his body, and odd, disconnected images flitted across the red darkness of his closed eyelids. He thought again how long it had been since last he and Chantel had made love together, and he wondered what the world would say if they knew of it. Nicholas Berg left a big empty place in his bed also, they would say. The hell with them, Duncan thought, but without the energy of real anger. The hell with all of them. And he gave himself up to the explosion of light that burst against his eyelids and the dark, but too fleeting peace that followed it. Nicholas lay back in the rather tatty old brown leather armchair, which was one of James Teacher's concessions to creature comfort, and he stared at the cheap hunting prints on the faded wallpaper through a thin fog of cheroot smoke. Teacher could have afforded a decent Gauguin or a Turner, but such vulgar display was frowned on in the Inns of Court. It might lead prospective clients to ponder the amount of the fees they were to be charged. James Teacher replaced the telephone and stood up behind his desk. It did not make much difference to his height. "Well, I think we've covered all the entrances to the Warren," he announced cheerfully. And he began to tick off the items on his fingers. "The sheriff of the South African Supreme Court will serve note of attachment on the hull of Golden Adventurer at noon local time tomorrow. Our French correspondent will do the same on Golden Dawn." He spoke for 3 minutes more, and listening to him, Nicholas reluctantly admitted to himself that he earned the greater proportion of his enormous fees. "Well, there it is, Mr. Berg. If your hunch is correct..." "It's not a hunch, Mr. Teacher. It's a certainty. Duncan Alexander has his backside pinched in the doorway. He's been rushing around the city like a demented man looking for money. My God, he even tried to stall me with that incredible offer of a partnership. No, Mr. Teacher, it's not a hunch. Christy Marine is going to default. I cannot understand that. 6 million is peanuts, said James Teacher. At least it's peanuts to a company like Christy Marine, one of the healthiest shipping owners. It was a year ago, Nicholas agreed grimly. But since then, Alexander has had a clear run, no checks. It's not a public company. He administers the shares in the trust. He drew on his cheroot. I'm going to use this to force a full investigation of the company's affairs. I'm going to have Alexander under the microscope, and we'll have a close look at all his pimples and warts. Teacher chuckled and picked up the telephone at the first ring. Teacher, he chuckled, and then laughed out loud, nodding. Yes, and yes again. He hung up and turned to Nicholas, his face bright red with mirth, fat and round as the setting sun. I have a disappointment for you, Mr. Berg, he guffawed. An hour ago, a transfer was made to the credit of Ocean Salvage in Bermuda by Christy Marine. How much? Every penny, Mr. Berg, in full and final payment. 6 million and some odd dollars in the legal currency of the United States of America. Nicholas stared at him, uncertain as to which of his emotions prevailed. Relief at having the money, or disappointment at being prevented from tearing Duncan Alexander to shreds. He's a high roller, and very fast on his feet, said Teacher. I wouldn't pay to underestimate a man like Duncan Alexander. No, it would not, Nicholas agreed quietly, knowing that he had done so more than once, and each time it had cost him dearly. I wonder if your clerk could find out from British Airways when the next flight leaves for Bermuda. You are leaving so soon? Will it be an order to mark my brief and send it direct to Bark Wacky in Bermuda? Teacher asked delicately. Bernard Wacky in person was waiting for Nicholas beyond the customs barrier. He was tall and lean and alert, burned by the sun, dark as a stick of chew tobacco, and dressed in open-neck shirt and cotton trousers. Nicholas, it's good to see you. His handshake was hard and dry and cool. He was under 60 and over 40. It was impossible to get nearer to his age. I'm taking you directly to the office. There's too much to discuss. I don't want to waste time. And he took Nicholas's arm and hurried him through burning sunlight into the shivery cold of the Rolls air conditioning. The car was too big for the island's narrow, winding roads. Here, ownership of automobiles was restricted to one per family unit, but Bernard made the most of his rights. He was one of those men whose combination of energy and brilliance made it impossible for him to live in England and to subject himself to punitive taxes of envy. It's hard to be a winner in a society dedicated to the glorification of losers, he had told Nicholas, and had moved his whole operation to this taxless haven. To a lesser man, it would have been suicide. But Bernard had taken over the top floor of the Bank of Bermuda building with a magnificent view across Hamilton Harbour, and had fitted it out with a marine operations room and a communications system the equal of NATO command. From it, he offered a service so efficient, so personally involved, so orientated to every single facet of ship ownership and operation. Not only had his old clients followed him, but others had come flocking. No taxes, Nicholas, he smiled, and look at the view. The picturesque buildings of Hamilton Town were painted in candy colours, strawberries and limes, plum and lemon, and across the bay The cedar trees stood tall in the sunlight, and the yachts and the pink-painted clubhouse spread multicoloured sails across green waters. It's better than London in winter, isn't it? The same temperature, said Nicholas, and glanced up at the air conditioning. I'm a hot-blooded man, Bernard explained. And when his tall, nubile secretary entered to his ring, bearing the ocean salvage files like a high priestess carrying the sacrament, Bernard fell into an awed silence, concentrating all his attention on her pneumatic bosoms. They bounced and strained against the laws of gravity as though filled with helium. She flashed a dazzling, painted smile at Nicholas as she placed the files on Bernard's desk. And then she left with her perfectly rounded buttocks under the tightly tailored skirt, swinging and dancing to distant music. She can type, too, Bernard assured Nick with a sigh, and shook his head as if to clear it. He opened the top file. Right, he began. The deposit from Christie Marine. The money had come in, and only just in time. The next installment on Sea Witch was already 48 hours overdue, and Atlantique were becoming highly agitated. Son of a gun, said Bernard. You'd not think 6 million was an easy sum of money to get rid of, would you? You don't even have to try, Nick agreed. It just spends itself. Then with a scowl, what's this? They've invoked the escalation clause again. Another 3.5% Sea Witch's builders had included a clause that related the contract price to the index cost of steel and the union labor rates. They had avoided the threatened dockyard strike by capitulating to union demands, and now the figures came back to Nicholas. They were big, fat, ugly figures. The clause was a festering canker to Nicholas, draining his strength and money. They worked on through the afternoon, paying, paying, and paying. Bunkers and the other running costs of Warlock, interest and capital repayments on the debts of Ocean Salvage, lawyers' fees, agents' fees, the 6 million whittled away. One of the few payments that gave Nicholas any pleasure was the 12.5% salvage money to the crew of Warlock. David Allen's share was almost $30,000. Beauty Baker, another $25,000. Nick included a note with the check. Have a Bundaberg on me. Is that all the payments? Nicholas asked at last. Isn't it enough? It's enough. Nick felt groggy with jet lag and from juggling with figures. What's next? Good news next. Bernard picked up the second file. I think I've squared Esso. They hate you. They have threatened never to use your tugs again. But they're not going to sue. Nicholas had breached contract when he deserted the Esso tow and ran south for Golden Adventurer. The breach of contract suit had been hanging since then. It was a relief to have it aside. Bernard Wacky was worth every penny of his hire. Okay, next. It went on for another 6 unbroken hours, piled on top of the jet lag that Nicholas had accumulated across the Atlantic. You okay? Bernard asked at last. Nicholas nodded, though his eyes felt like hard-boiled eggs, and his chin was dark and raspy with beer. You want something to eat? Bernard asked. And then Nick shook his head and realized that it was dark outside. Drink? You'll need one for what comes next. The scotch, Nicholas agreed. And the secretary brought the tray through and poured the drinks in another respectful hush. That will be all, Mr. Wacky? For now, honey? Bernard watched her go, and then saluted Nicholas with his glass. I give you the Golden Prince. And when Nicholas scowled, he went on swiftly. No, Nicholas, I'm not shafting you. It's for real. You've done it again. The sheikhs are fixing to make you an offer. They want to buy you out clean, take over the whole show, liabilities, everything. Of course, they want you to run it for them 2 years while you train one of their own men. A hell of a salary, he went on crisply, and Nicholas stared at him. How much? 200 grand, plus 2.5% profits. Not the salary, Nicholas told him. How much are they offering for the company? They're Arabs. The first offer is just to stir the pot a little. How much? Nicholas asked impatiently. The sum of 5 was delicately mentioned. What do you think they'll go to? 7? 7.5? 8, perhaps. Through the fuzz of fatigue, far off like a lantern in the window of a winter's night, Nicholas saw the vision of a new life, a life such as Samantha had shown him, a life uncluttered, uncomplicated, shorn of all but joy and purpose. $8 million clear. Nicholas's voice was husky, and he tried to wipe away the fatigue from his stinging eyelids with thumb and forefinger. Maybe only 7, Bernard demurred, but I'd try for 8. I'll have another drink, Nicholas said. That's a splendid idea, Bernard agreed, and rang for his secretary with an anticipatory sparkle in his eyes. Samantha wore her hair in twin braids down her back and hacked off denim pants, which left her long brown legs bare and exposed a pale sliver of tight round buttock at each step as she walked away. She had sandals on her feet and sunglasses pushed onto the top of her head. I thought you were never coming, she challenged Nick as he stepped through the barrier at Miami International. He dropped his bag and fielded her rush against his chest. She clung to him, and he had forgotten the clean, sun-drenched smell of her hair. She was trembling with a suppressed eagerness like a puppy. It was only when a small, quivering sob shook her shoulders that he realized she was weeping. Hey, now. He lifted her chin, and her eyes were flooded. She snuffled once loudly. What's the trouble, little one? I'm just so happy, Samantha told him. And deeply, Nicholas envied the ability to live so near the surface. To be able to cry with joy seemed to him at that moment to be the supreme human accomplishment. He kissed her, and she tasted salty with tears. With surprise, he felt a choke deep in his own throat. The jaded airport crowds had to open and trickle around the two of them like water around a rock, and they were oblivious to it all. Even when they came out of the building into the Florida sunlight, she had both arms around his waist, hampering his stride as she led him to her vehicle. Good God, exclaimed Nicholas, and he shied when he saw it. It was a Chevy van, but its paintwork had been restyled. What's that? It's a masterpiece, she laughed, isn't it? It was rainbowed, in layers of vibrant color and panels of fantastic landscapes and seascapes. You did that? Nick asked, and he took his dark glasses from his breast pocket and inspected the seagulls and palm trees and flowers through them. It's not that bad, she protested. I was bored and depressed without you. I needed something to brighten my life. One of the panels depicted the translucent green of a curling wave, and on the face of the wave, a pair of human figures on Hawaii boards and a graceful dolphin shape flew in formation together. Nick leaned closer and barely recognized the male figure as himself. Each detail of the features had been rendered with loving attention, and he came out of it looking something between Clark Gable and Superman, only a little more glamorous. From memory, she said proudly. It's tremendous, he told her. but I've got bigger biceps, and I'm more beautiful. Despite the wild choice of colour and the romantic style, he realized that she had real talent. You don't expect me to ride in that. What if one of my creditors saw me? Get your mind out of its stiff collar and blue suit, mister. You have just signed on for the voyage to Never Neverland by way of the moon. Before she started the engine, she looked at him seriously out of those great shining green eyes. How long, Nicholas? She asked. How long have we got together this time? 10 days, he told her. Sorry, but I must be back in London by the 25th. There's a big one coming up. The big one. I'll tell you about it. No. She covered her ears with both hands. I don't want to hear about it. Not yet. She drove the Chevy with careless, unforced skill, very fast and efficiently, acknowledging the homage of other male drivers with a grin and a shake of her braids. When she slipped off Highway 95 and parked in the lot of a supermarket, Nicholas raised an eyebrow. Food, she explained, and then with a lascivious roll of her eyes, I reckon I had to get mighty hungry later. She chose steaks, a bag full of groceries, and a jug of Californian Riesling, and would not let him pay. In this town, you are my guest. Then she paid the toll and took the Rickenbacker Causeway across the water to Virginia Key. That's the Marine Division of the University of Miami, and that's my lab at the top of the jetty, just beyond that white fishing boat. See it? The low buildings were crowded into a corner of the island, between the Sea Aquarium and the wharves and jetties of the university's own little harbor. We aren't stopping, Nicholas observed. Are you kidding? She laughed at him. I don't need a controlled scientific environment for the experiment I'm about to conduct. And with no diminution of speed, the Chevy flew across the long bridge between Virginia Key and Key Biscayne. And 3 miles on, she turned off sharply, left, on a narrow dirt track that twisted through a lush tropical maritime forest of banyan and palmetto and palm, and ended at a clapboard shack just above the water. I live close to the shop, Samantha explained, as she clattered up onto the screened porch, her arms full of groceries. This is yours? Nicholas asked. He could just make out the tops of big blocks of condominiums on each side. They were completely screened by the palms. Pa left it to me. He bought it the year I was born, Samantha explained proudly. My ground stretches from there to there. A few hundred yards, but Nicholas realized the value of it. Everybody in the world wants to live on the water, and those condominiums were pressing in closely. It must be worth a million. There's no price on it, she said firmly. That's what I tell those awful, sweaty little men with their big cigars. Pa left it to me, and it's not for sale. She had the door open now, bumping it with her denim-clad backside. Don't just stand there, Nicholas, she implored him. We've only got 10 days. He followed her into the kitchen as she dumped her load into the sink and whirled back to him. Welcome by my house, Nicholas. And then, as she slid her arms around his waist, jerked his shirt tails out of his belt, and slid her hands up his bare back. You'll never know just how welcome. Come, let me show you around. This is the living room. It was Spartan furniture with Indian rugs and pottery, and Samantha's chopped-off denims were discarded in the center of the floor along with Nicholas's shirt. And this, surprise, surprise, is the bedroom. She dragged him by one hand, and under the short T-shirt, her bottom reminded him of a chipmunk with his cheeks stuffed with nuts, chewing vigorously. The tiny bedroom overlooked the beach. The sea breeze fluffed out the curtains, and the sound of the low surf breathed like a sleeping giant, a deep, regular hiss and sigh that filled the air around them. The bed was too big for the room, all ornate antique brass, with a cloudy, soft mattress and an old-fashioned patchwork quilt in 100 coloured and patterned squares. "I don't think I could have lived another day without you," she said, and unwound the thick plaits of her hair. "You came like the cavalry, in the very nick of time." He reached up and took the golden tresses of her hair, winding them thickly around his wrist, twining them in his fingers, and pulled her gently down beside him. Suddenly, Nick's life was uncluttered and simple again. Suddenly he was young and utterly carefree again. The petty strivings, the subterfuge, the lies and the cheating did not exist in this little universe that encompassed a tiny wooden shack on the edge of the ocean, and a huge brass bed that clanged and rattled and banged and squeaked with the wholesale, the completely abandoned happiness that was the special miracle called Samantha Silver. Samantha's laboratory was a square room built on piles over the water, and the soft hum of the electric pumps blended with the slap of the wavelets below and the burble and blurp of the tanks. "This is my kingdom," she told him, "and these are my subjects." There were almost 100 tanks, like the small glass-sided aquaria for goldfish, and suspended over each of them was a complicated arrangement of coils and bottles and electric wiring. Nick sauntered across the nearest of the tanks and peered into it. It contained a single large saltwater clam. The animal was feeding with the double shells agape, the pink soft flesh and frilly gills rippling and undulating in the gentle flow of pumped and filtered seawater. To each half of the shell, the thin copper wires were attached with blobs of polyurethane cement. Samantha came to stand beside him, touching, and he asked her, "What's happening?" She touched a switch, and immediately the cylindrical scroll above the tank began to revolve slowly, and a stylus, after a few preliminary jerks and quivers, began to trace out a regular pattern on the paper scroll. A trough and double peak, the second a fraction lower than the first, and then the trough again. She said, "He's wired and bugged." "You're a member of the CIA," he accused. And she laughed. His heart beat. "I'm passing an electric impulse through the heart. The heart is only a millimeter across. But each spasm changes the resistance and moves the stylus." She studied the curve for a moment. "This fellow is one very healthy, cheerful Spicula solidissima." "Is that his name?" Nick asked. "I thought he was a clam." "One of 15,000 bivalves who use that common generic," she corrected. "I had to pick an egghead," said Nicholas ruefully. "But what's so interesting about his heart?" "It's the closest and cheapest thing to a pollution meter that we've discovered so far. Or rather," she corrected herself without false modesty, "that I have discovered." She took his hand and led him down the long row of tanks. They are sensitive, incredibly sensitive to any contamination of their environment, and the heartbeat will register almost immediately any foreign element or chemical, organic or otherwise, in such low concentrate that it would take a highly trained specialist with a spectroscope to detect otherwise. Nicholas felt his mild attention changing and growing into real interest as Samantha began to prepare samples of common pollutants on the single bench against the forewall of the cluttered little laboratory. "Here." She held up one test tube. "Aromatic carbons. the more poisonous elements of crude petroleum. And here, she indicated the next tube, mercury in a concentration of 100 parts to the million. Did you see the photographs of the human vegetables and the Japanese children with the flesh falling off their bones at Keijo? That was mercury. Lovely stuff. She picked up another tube, PCB, a byproduct of the electrical industry. The Hudson River is thick with it. And these, tetrahydrofurane, cyclohexane, methylbenzene, all industrial byproducts, but don't let the fancy names throw you. One day they will come back to haunt us in newspaper headlines as THF or CMB. One day there'll be other human cabbages and babies born without arms or legs. She touched the other tubes. Arsenic, old-fashioned Agatha Christie vintage poison. And then here is the real living and breathing bastard daddy of them all. This is cadmium. It's a sulfide, so it's easily absorbed. In 100 parts to the million, it's as lethal as a neutron bomb. While he watched, she carried the tray of tubes across to the tanks and set the ECG monitors running. Each began to record the normal, double-peaked heartbeat of a healthy clam. "Now," she said, "watch this." Under controlled conditions, she began to drip the weak poison solutions into the reticulated water systems, a different solution to each of the tanks. These concentrations are so low that the animals will not even be aware of trauma. They will continue to feed and breed without any but long-term indications of systematic poisoning. Samantha was a different person, a cool, quick-thinking professional. Even the white dust coat that she had slipped over her T-shirt altered her image, and she had aged 20 years in poisoned authority as she passed back and forth along the row of tanks. "There," she said, with grim satisfaction, as the stylus on one recording drum made a slightly double beat at its peak, and then just detectably flattened the second peak. Typical aromatic carbon reaction. The distorted heartbeat was repeated endlessly on the slowly turning drum, and she passed on to the next tank. See the pulse in the trough? See the fractional speeding up of the heart spasm? That's cadmium in 10 parts to the million. At 100 parts, it'll kill all sea life. At 500, it will kill man slowly. At 700 parts in air or solution, it will kill him very quickly indeed. Nicholas's interest became total fascination as he helped Samantha record the experiments and control the flow and concentration in the tanks. Slowly, they increased the dosage of each substance, and the moving stylus dispassionately recorded the increasing distress and the final convulsions and spasmodic throes that preceded death. Nicholas voiced the tickle of horror and revulsion he felt at watching the process of degeneration. "It's macabre." "Yes." She stood back from the tanks. Death always is. "But these organisms have such rudimentary nervous systems, they don't experience pain as we know it." She shuddered slightly herself and went on. "But imagine an entire ocean poisoned like one of these tanks. Imagine the incredible agonies of tens of millions of seabirds, of the mammals, seals and porpoises and whales. And think of what would happen to man himself." Samantha shrugged off her white dust coat. "Now, I'm hungry," she announced. And then looking up at the fiberglass panels in the roof. "No wonder, it's dark already." While they cleaned and tidied the laboratory and made a last check on the pumps and running equipment, Samantha told him, "In 5 hours... we have tested over 150 samples of contaminated water and got accurate indications of nearly 50 dangerous substances at a probable cost of 50 cents a sample. as he switched out the lights. To do the same with a gas spectroscope would have cost about $10,000 and taken a highly specialized team to work 2 weeks of hard work. "It's a hell of a trick," Nicholas told her. "You're a clever lady. I'm impressed. I really am." At the psychedelic Chevy van, she stopped him, and in the light of the street lamp, looked up at him guiltily. "Do you mind if I show you off, Nicholas?" "What does that mean?" he asked suspiciously. "The gang are eating shrimps tonight. Then they'll sleep over on the boat and have the first shot at fish tagging tomorrow. But we don't have to go. We could just get some more steaks and another jug of wine." But he could see she really wanted to go. She was 55 foot, an old purse seiner, with the ungainly wheelhouse forehead like a sentry box or an old-fashioned pit latrine. Even with her coat of new paint, she had an old-fashioned look. She was tied up at the end of the university jetty, and as they walked out to her, so they could hear the voices and the laughter coming up from below decks. "Tricky Dicky," Nicholas read her name on the high, ugly, rounded stern. "But we love her," Samantha said, and led him across the narrow, rickety gangplank. "She belongs to the university. She's only one of our four research vessels. The others are all fancy modern ships, 200-footers. But the Dickie is our boat for short field trips to the Gulf or down the Keys, and she's also the faculty clubhouse." The main cabin was monastically furnished, bare planking and hard benches, a single long table, but it was as crowded as a fashionable discotheque, packed solid with sunburned young people, girls and boys all in faded jeans and T-shirts. Impossible to judge sexes by clothing or by the length of their sun-tortured and wind-tangled hair. The air was thick with the rich smell of broiling Gulf shrimps and molten butter, and there were gallons of California wine on the table. "Hey!" Samantha shouted above the uproar of voices raised in heavy dispute and jovial repartee. "This is Nicholas." A comparative silence descended on the gathering, and they looked him over with the curious veiled group hostility of any tribe for an interloper, an intruder in a closed and carefully guarded group. Nick returned the scrutiny calmly, met each pair of eyes, while realizing that despite the affected informality of their dress and some of the wildly unkempt hairstyles and the impressive profusion of beards, they were an elite group. There was not a face that was not intelligent, not a pair of eyes that was not alert and quick, and there was that special feeling of pride and self-confidence in all of them. At the head of the table sat a big, impressive figure, the oldest man in the cabin, perhaps Nick's age or a little older, for there were silver strands in his beard, and his face was lined and beaten by sun and wind and time. "Hi, Nick," he boomed. "I won't pretend we've never heard of you. Sam has given us all cauliflower ears." "You cut that out, Tom Parker." Samantha stopped him sharply, and there was a ripple of laughter, a relaxation of tension, and a casual round of greetings. "Hi, Nick. I'm Sally Ann." A pretty girl with china blue eyes behind wire-frame spectacles put a heavy tumbler of wine into his hand. "We're short of glasses. Guess you and Sam will have to share."